remember the yesterdays, the poverty that you and me survived. For we tried living on streets that weren't giving, and laughed and cried in youth we died and didn't know. Yes, my friends, our history, the memory shall carry me until we're free. The times we saw we didn't deserve, hostility we couldn't see, it was absurd. But we gave joy, each girl and boy, so innocent our future bent against the wind. Yes, my friends, our history, the memory shall carry me until we're free. Desperate kisses in alleyways, the future days they laid to waste our little lives. The concrete park, a stab in the dark, to rest our soul, and we were old before we grew. Oh yes, my friends,
our history,
the memory shall carry me until we're free. Some friends forgotten and some are gone. How dare they touch our little spot with what they've done? I miss them all, but the future calls, demanding we set ourselves free as we should be. Oh yes, my friends. The memory shall carry me until we're free.
You just heard music from Elaine Brown. The name of the song is Until We're Free, and that is one of many tracks that is featured on a new collection, which is actually a companion to a book. The name of the compilation is Listen Whitey, The Sounds of Black Power, 1967-1974. Companion to a book that has the same title, The Sights and Sounds of Black Power. We're here with the author of that book and the main force behind this compilation as well, Pat Thomas. How are you doing, Pat?
Good. Glad to be here on KPFK.
We're very glad to have you here as well. I was one of the things I was really interested in just here at the start was if you could just talk a little bit about how this whole project came together.
It started off very organically in the sense that I wasn't really looking to do a book. I had moved to Oakland around the year 2000, mm-hmm. and I've always been interested in various counterculture and political movements. In the 1980s, I got to briefly meet Abby Hoffman of the Yippies, and I met Allen Ginsberg and people like that. And so I just started casually reading Black Panther biographies. And I found myself reaching out to David Hilliard, who was chief of staff of the Black Panther Party during their glory years, mm-hmm. Erica Huggins, Bobby Seale, of course, a legend. And I got to know some of these people, especially David, really well. And we'd go to dinner and talk. And I never put a microphone on anybody. I never, you know, asked anyone for a formal interview. I just kind of got to know them. And meanwhile, my day job, which I currently do for Light in the Attic Records, but I've done for other labels, is digging through the vaults of Warner Brothers and Atlantic and looking at vintage soul and R&B and mm-hmm. folk and rock. And so I guess my interest in the Black Panther Party started to veer off into music and recordings. In this particular case, here's Elaine Brown, who was a key member of the Black Panther Party. She started off here in Los Angeles, and then mm-hmm. she moved to Oakland. She has the distinction of being the only woman to rise to the level of chairman of the party. When Huey Newton left the country in 1974, he picked her to replace him. So that's pretty amazing that this organization that's known as being a male-dominated, somewhat paramilitary organization, although I disagree with that comment, but, is run by a female. And even more interesting is here's a Black Panther who's signed to Motown. The track that we heard came out on Motown through their subsidiary, Black Forum, which was a short-lived subsidiary that specialized in Black Power and political statements.
Yeah, and so had you Had you known about either Elaine Brown's recordings or kind of music associated with the movement before kind of moving to Oakland and then kind of making your way through or connecting yourself to former members of the Black Panther Party?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I was into British folk music for a long time. So, you know, I was digging into, you know, obscure offshoots of Fairport Convention. Then I got into krautrock, and I was digging into, you know, solo albums for members of Can. So this whole sort of era and genre of recordings was fairly new to me. And over a 5-year period, a lot of time spent on eBay trying to outbid the other guy, this, that, and the other. And the next thing I knew, I had like 250, you know, albums, of many of which most crate diggers haven't seen.
So for the book, a lot of that entire collection is you know, makes its way into the book. The compilation is a very different kind of beast, as it were. You know, how do you make the decision going from, you know, 250 possible records that you could bring out to, you know, the relatively few tracks, considering that are actually on this CD?
Well, first of all, what I did is I decided consciously to not put any jazz recordings on this particular compilation. At some point, there'll be a separate Listen Whitey Black Power Jazz compilation.
Okay.
So that sort of removed at least 50 to 100 records right there. But really, what I focused on the compilation, there's 16 tracks, but there's at least 8 of them that have never been on compact disc before. Several that have never come out in any form. And so the idea was, is as you read through the book, you know, this was a way to, you know, obviously I couldn't satisfy everyone's taste, but here's 16 songs that most of which, you know, are probably not in your collection. And the other thing is I wanted to go for diversity. I've got political speeches by Stokely Carmichael and Eldridge Cleaver. I've got comedy from Dick Gregory. I've got, you know, classic rock legends, Bob Dylan, John Lennon. And then, of course, I have, you know, Gil Scott-Heron, The Last Poets, The Watts Prophets. So it was meant to be this sort of multi-genre, multicultural thing. And we purposely did it as one CD because we wanted, frankly, something that people could go out and afford. You know, if we'd done a 5-CD box set for $100, you know, that would have outpriced it for everybody. So, you know, here's a single disc, you know, that's reasonably priced. And frankly, a lot of kids have been buying it, a lot of younger people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things that I hope to remember to ask you a little bit later on in thinking about kind of the connections between this prior period and more contemporary times. One of the things that I was interested in, especially in the selection process for the CD, around kind of just what constitutes kind of sounds of Black Power. There are some things on here that are very clearly and directly linked to particular groups that have particular messages that fall explicitly in line with kind of Black Power ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other things that are either somewhat connected or clearly in line with it. And some things that seem to be more about the kind of surrounding time. And so that was one of the things I wanted you to talk a little bit more about, just kind of how you build or bring all these different diverse sounds under the same kind of umbrella as sounds of Black Power.
Well, the first thing that I learned as I dove into researching the book is that outsiders, of which I'm one, tend to lump movements in together. So we automatically assume, like, Angela Davis must have been best friends with Huey, and Huey Newton must have been hanging out with Amiri, Baraka, and so on. And you realize, like, no, there's many very different factions. You know, Amiri Baraka was a Black nationalist, which meant he would wear a dashiki, and he changed his name from Leroy Jones to Amiri and learned Swahili phrases. Mm-hmm. Huey Newton was never going to put on a dashiki. Huey Newton had no interest in exploring his Afrocentric roots. He considered himself an American, and in his mind, the revolution started right here in America.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important for people to remember that we can't just lump all these various groups into one melting pot. And that's part of what the CD does as well. So there's Amiri and the Shahid Quintet that are representing black nationalists. Stokely sort of switched. He aligned himself with the Panthers, and then he switched over to being a black nationalist. So he sort of represents, you know, both groups. But you know, as I say in the liner notes of the CD, it's important to remember that these individuals didn't necessarily speak for or to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, another common misconception is that Angela Davis was a Black Panther. She wasn't. She was a member of the Communist Party. And so my book and the CD try to say, like, you know, let's celebrate the diversity of ideologies. And because I'm an outsider and I wasn't obviously there in the 60s, I was a child. I'm not necessarily picking or choosing one group over another, although I will say that my heart and soul sort of rests with the Panthers because I got to know them, and I'm the most enamored with them.
Why don't we play something that's directly tied to the Panthers, and then talk a little bit about it as well. So one of the tracks that's on here is from a group that was directly associated with the Black Panther Party. They were called the Lumpin', and the song that is on the compilation is Free Bobby Now. Once again, this comes from the Lumpin', and the name of the song is Free Bobby Now from the collection Listen Whitey, Sounds of Black Power, 1967-1974, with our guest, the author and compiler, Pat Thomas, here at KPFK. So you just heard the Lumpin' here on KPFK and Melting Pot. That is a group that not a lot of people know about. Very few people have probably a copy of the original 45 that featured that song, Free Bobby Now. The Lumpin' were a group that was directly related to the Black Panther Party. That's correct, Pat?
Yeah, the Lumpin' story is interesting. These are four what we call rank-and-file members of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. No legends there, no names that people would have heard. And these guys, you know, everybody in the party had a job, you know, be it distributing the newspaper or, you know, washing the dishes for the free breakfast program, what have you. So these particular four guys, they were in a warehouse somewhere, and they were basically collating the weekly newspaper, you know, assembling it and getting it ready for distribution. And of course, they'd have the radio playing, and in the radio would have the Temptations or the Supremes, and so they found themselves singing along. And all of a sudden, they realize, like, hey, we can kind of harmonize like the Temps. Meanwhile, the name of the band, the Lumpen, is short for the Lumpen Proletariat. And without getting into too much dogmatic politics, Lumpen Proletariat was a phrase that Karl Marx came up with. And he saw that as the lowest class of people in the social economic rung. And he thought these people were too lowly to be important in the revolution.
Yeah, the dangerous class.
Exactly. Now, Huey Newton thought, no, this is exactly the people that I want to help, you know, collaborate on the revolution. And so Emery Douglas, who designed a lot of the Panthers' posters and their logos and things, he said, hey, let's call this band the Lumpen. And so their thing was, is they were four guys dressed in similar suits, kind of like the Temptations. They had, you know, backing musicians, and they recorded a single called Free Bobby Now. Bobby is obviously Bobby Seale, who was on trial at that point for various things. And the single was pressed, distributed by the party, which is one of the reasons you can't really find it. You know, it didn't make it into a lot of record stores. It was probably sold on the street or various Panther rallies. And it's really funky and really groovy. And, you know, it's the first time it's been on CD, and so I was honored to have those guys give me permission to use it.
Yeah, and I think that's one of, you know, there've been some collections over the, you know, past several years to kind of put together music of this period of time or music associated with the civil rights movement, but there haven't been a lot of collections that really deal with kind of this specific period of time and really dealing with kind of the Black Power movement, things that are really directly associated with, that are literally movement music of this particular moment. And so that was one of the things that really excited me, you know, to have that music finally. I've been looking for a copy of that for you know, I lived in the Bay Area for 9 years. I never saw a copy of that record.
Yeah.
I know my friend Ricky Vinson, who's on our sister station, KPFA, and does a brilliant show there, History of Funk, is kind of in preparation to hopefully, you know, tell their story and get
Ricky,
that story
yeah,
out.
Ricky, I have to credit Ricky for telling me about the Lumpen. And, just a quick plug, in about a year or two, there will be a book out by Ricky that's pretty much exclusively about the Lumpen.
Yeah.
So
yeah. We're really excited about that.
Yeah.
Continuing kind of a little guided tour throughout this collection and also connecting to the book as well. One of the other tracks on here that I think may be a surprise to a number of people, and also a track that, as far as I know, hasn't really been in print in the CD age, is this song, also associated in ways with the Black Panther Party, because it's dedicated to the Soledad brother, George Jackson, is tracked by Bob Dylan that's on here. How did you get this track on this collection?
Well, first of all, I just want to give people a quick George Jackson 101. George Jackson had been arrested in the early to mid-60s for robbing a grocery store for $70 and was sentenced to 1 year to life. And after a couple of years, George got the feeling like it was going to be life. And so he became more politicized, you know, wrote some excellent books, and became sort of a honorary member of the party within the prison system. And then Angela Davis took up his cause, and he sort of became an iconic figure, even though he was still in prison. And so the California prison system thought, well, you know, he's getting just a little too much press for our liking. And without getting into big conspiracy theories, let's just say that George was shot down in prison by a guard. And Dylan, this is 1970, 71. Dylan, who had not written political songs in years, you know, he'd written more sort of psychedelic personal songs like a Rolling Stone or All Along the Watchtower. It had been years since he'd written a Blowing in the Wind or Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was moved to write this song, George Jackson, within days of George's assassination, release it as a single. And then it just sort of disappeared. There's been countless Dylan best ofs, box sets, whatever. For whatever reason, unknown to me, Dylan has never saw fit to reissue the song. So anyway, as I was working on this compilation, it was obviously a song that I thought, wow, this is great. I love Dylan. I love the subject matter. I love this song. I contacted Bob's people, for lack of a better word. And within 24 hours, they're like, Bob loves this idea. He's totally down with it. You're in. And so that was amazing, because he obviously gets lots of offers to do lots of things. And so it just showed you that in 2012, you know, that Bob's ideologies are, you know, remain, you know, He's on the right side of the tracks.
Yeah, and it's I think that the other version, if memory serves correct, this was kind of the same song was on both sides of the original.
Yeah, what he did, and this is also kind of a cool move on his part at the time. He knew that if he put a less militant song on the B side, that the radio stations would go for that.
Mm-hmm.
So what he did is he recorded a big band version, kind of almost a gospel-y kind of New Orleans thing that did appear in the 70s on an Australian compilation. This is a solo acoustic version, very similar to his early 60s topical songs. And again, this is the first time this has come out, has been in the CDH.
Yeah, and I had heard the kind of full band version, and it doesn't have the power that this. I mean, it's just part of it is kind of, you know, what makes Dylan legendary for so many people, but just the kind of simplicity of that voice with guitar and the starkness of the lyrical content and the story. There's no way to be distracted. Like you pay attention, even if you don't know the story. It kind of hits you even more.
Yeah, I mean, this is corny to say, but this song actually has moved me to tears when I listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
It really does.
I could see that happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll play it right now. So this is, again, a song that more or less disappeared from memory, at least for a whole lot of people, when it was originally released in 1971. Never been issued on CD since then, and finds itself finally here on this collection. Listen, Whitey, The Sounds of Black Power, 1967 to 1974. This is Bob Dylan in the acoustic version of George Jackson that you're hearing right now on KPFK and Melting Pot.
I woke up this morning, there were tears in my bed. Killed a man I really loved, shot him through the head. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground. Sent him off to prison for a $70 rivalry. They closed the door behind him and they threw away the key. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground. He wouldn't take space from no one. He wouldn't bow down or kneel. Authorities, they hated him because it was just too real. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground. They cursed him as they watched him from above. But they were frightened of his power. They were scared of his love. Lord, Lord, so they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground. Some of us are prisoners, the rest of us are gods. Lord, Lord, they cut George Jackson down. Lord, Lord, they laid him in the ground.
That was Bob Dylan and his song George Jackson, which tells some of the story of sold out brother George Jackson, and written in the wake of his assassination. The Attica prison riots also happening in the wake of George Jackson's assassination, a major period of time in our nation's history, and something that is collected on The Sounds of Black Power, 1967-1974. Full title, Listen Whitey, Sounds of Black Power, and also in the book that Pat Thomas has put together called The Sights and Sounds of Black Power, Listen Whitey. One of the things that is interesting about this collection is the title in and of itself. And the title comes from a Stokely Carmichael record and kind of part of what's connected to the speech, which you do have part of that on this compilation.
Correct.
But this was one of the things that's really, in and of itself, very interesting about this collection. I was wondering about kind of the choice of titling this book and the collection, because both of them, it's like you can't escape it. It's on both of these, Listen Whitey, The Sights and Sounds of Black Power, and The Sounds of Black Power for the CD. Why that particular title?
Well, it's, you know, it is a little provocative. You know, obviously, it's a little bit of a tribute to that particular album. That's obviously where I got it from, an album that came back in the day. Stanley Nelson, who's a film producer and director, he's done a lot of great documentaries for PBS about the Freedom Riders and Marcus Garvey. He was kind enough to do the foreword to the book. And he said something very poignant. He said, technically, it's not Listen Whitey. It's really Listen Brothers and Sisters, because the songs that are on here were not meant, frankly, for white people to listen to and stand up and go, what the hell's going on? But they were really meant for members of the black community.
Yeah.
But as he pointed out, he said, look, if I was walking through the bookstore and I saw a book called Listen Brother, he goes, I might just walk right by it. But I walk by and I say, Listen Whitey, I'm like, what the heck is that?
Uh-huh.
You know, so yeah, so it's you know, it's a little provocative, and yet, you know, without getting into like a whole race discussion, you know, as a white person, the title Whitey, I mean, is so, you know, I mean, it's not like the N-word, you know, obviously.
Yeah, it doesn't have that power.
It doesn't have that power.
But it's still something, and you know, part of, you know, the way that race and privilege works in this country is that there are very few words that would have that kind of comparable power. But this is one, even though you don't hear it too often, and
yeah,
that's kind of part of the charm, as it were.
Right.
It's still one that kind of it gets your attention very quickly.
Yeah. And it, I'm not sure what else to say other than, you know, I personally love the word honky better. I find that more bemusing. And I think I say in the book something about it's time to bring that word back into the vernacular. But anyway, I'm not sure what else to say here.
No, and I think that, you know, that one of the things that's been interesting to me in playing this collection over the last, you know, month and a half, couple months, since I got a copy, is the range of kind of reactions to it. From people who hear a track and are just kind of shocked and surprised in the most positive way and want to track it down because they've either never heard these sounds or they haven't heard these sounds in very long, and it's kind of connected to an educational process, learning about that period of time, to people who kind of more casually are listening and are kind of hit over the head with the messages of some of these songs and then, you know, feel like even now, a lot of this material is still too controversial, almost as if we shouldn't be kind of talking about race, talking about racial politics, the politics of race in this country during this time or even the current time, openly on the public airwaves in quite this manner.
Well, one thing I want to say for the listeners who haven't seen the book or read the book, this is not an academic book.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a book filled with dogmatic politics. I don't offer any theories. I don't pretend to know or feel what it was like to be part of the black militant experience. The book is really it's a fun book. And I know that's a strange word to use for a book about black power, but it is a fun book because it shows you where Black power and pop culture intersected. Mm-hmm. Obviously, music is the key thing, but there's a funny story about the Partridge Family, you know, the TV sitcom with David Cassidy. First season, the writers decide to do an episode that has cameos from Black Panthers that are obviously actors. But it shows you that Hollywood is all of a sudden going like, hey, this is a movement that we need to address recognize in some way. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, the 1968 Mexico City Olympics and the Black Power salute. I mean, that image is iconic. Mm-hmm. And when an image becomes broadcast all over the world, in my mind, that becomes part of popular culture. So I really see this book is like in the same way that classic rock fans still celebrate the 1969 Woodstock Festival, mm-hmm. right? We watch the movie and we buy the box sets. We're like, oh my God, this is great. Well, this is my version of that, except for the Black Power movement. It's like, you know, let's celebrate this in song and let's celebrate it with its various television and iconic images, and so I try to keep my opinions out of the book, mm-hmm. And yeah, it's very different than if I was you know, a PhD from UCLA and coming on and going, well, the Black experience means blah 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 blah. that's not what I'm doing, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why people have embraced the book and the CD, because they can see that it's really just about the music. I gave a lecture in Seattle to 250 people, mixed audience, but mostly African Americans. And one older Black gentleman stood up and said, you know, I feel like you're speaking for me, and I don't appreciate that. And then Aaron Dixon, who was the captain of the Seattle Black Panthers during their peak, stood up and he said, no, this gentleman is only talking about music. And I'm here to say that music was very, very important to me and the Panthers. And so I think you should sit down and let this gentleman continue speaking. Hmm. You know, obviously I felt validated. And it also just drove home the point that, yeah, I'm not up there lecturing about what it means to be Black or any of that. It's really about the music for me.
Yeah. And I think that the strengths of both the book and the way that the liner notes, because these are you know, fairly extensive notes in terms of talking about each of the artists or the speakers and about kind of the record and kind of either where it comes from, how it came to be, a particular label gives, you know, it gives you kind of historical and biographical information and context. It's not necessarily an analysis of the success or failures of the movement, the things that get correct or wrong. It really is more of like a historical document, very much kind of from a, I would say, kind of from a like a collector's perspective kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
And to make sure that this is out there and that people can more readily find it, which has been the great difficulty. You know, a lot of people, you know, people like me who dig in all kinds of record stores, and, you know, like I've owned or have seen many of these records, but, you know, I'm just one person. There's a lot of people who have no idea, who don't know about mm-hmm. the original Last Poets, let alone the Last Poets,
right.
or
the differences,
the Watts Prophets, or any of that Stokely Carmichael and Eldridge Cleaver and other members of this movement actually put out albums that you can find their speeches, that you can hear them,
mm-hmm.
in addition to seeing them in some documentaries. And the awareness, being able to hear this kind of music and hear the various kinds of things that were going around in that movement, I think really is an important thing. I'm very happy to have it have been done.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to validate myself or pat myself on the back, but the last thing I'll say on this subject is, you know, I got to know Elaine Brown very, very well over a period of years, and Elaine doesn't mince words, you know, she just said to me, she said, Pat, what I love about you is you're not trying to be Black.
Mm-hmm.
She said, you know, people come into our circle, you know, today and in the past, and they want to pretend that they're Black and want to talk like Blacks talk, whatever that's supposed to mean. And she just said, you know, you're not trying to pretend to be somebody you're not. And I really appreciate that. And therefore you have my respect. And obviously, you know, I respect her, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the other thing. In my lectures, I don't try to, and I don't come out and say, "Hey, brothers and sisters, thanks for coming here today." You know, I don't try to put on some sort of phony pseudo, you know, black hipster thing, because I'm mm-hmm. not. I'm a middle class white guy.
Yeah. So there are some plans. You mentioned this earlier. There are some plans for additional volumes, in terms of CDs, LPs, collections. You mentioned something about having almost a separate volume for kind of more jazz-oriented things.
Yeah, I mean, the part of the book that was the most difficult for me to write and research is, you know, I'm a jazz fan in the sense I love, you know, everybody loves Miles, and I love sort of what some people consider pop jazz, like Les McCann and Eddie Harris. I'd never really dug into the free jazz movement, Archie Shepp, Art Ensemble Chicago, Clifford Thornton. So that was something where I really had to dig in. I had to find mm-hmm. those records and try to figure out what that all meant. And along the way, I discovered, you know, that these guys were you know, caught up in the movement, and most of them actually tended more towards the black nationalist side. A lot of them moved to Europe and performed in North Africa, and so I've kind of have a collection in the back of my mind that'll really kind of explore that stuff. Free jazz, a lot of it with vocals, for example, mm-hmm. And things like that. And So that'll be coming down the pike. Unfortunately, not anytime soon. I probably should have, you know, started working on it a year ago. But anyway.
And then just a final question. I was wondering, this is something I kind of intimated earlier. I was wondering, in hearing this music, and I guess it's almost kind of like a two-part question, both thinking about the kind of legacy of these sounds for other artists and musicians, and maybe the legacy of these sounds for regular folk, and kind of a reclaiming of part of a history that is not has not been readily available. I was wondering your thoughts on kind of both of those things, perhaps.
Okay. I would say that, you know, there are definitely contemporary artists that are plugged into this, and I'm far from a rap or a hip hop fan, or and certainly not an expert or scholar, but I know that, you know, for example, Nas mm-hmm. Has sampled and picked up on some of this stuff. Saul Williams, Michael Franti, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm sure, you know, other people like Oliver Wang or Jeff Chang and yourself could sit here and rattle off a lot more artists than I could. So, you know, so it's always been sort of the, you know, the rappers and the DJs and the hip hopper guys that actually started before I did. I mean, I dove into this maybe about 6 or 7 years ago. But mm-hmm. before that, people like yourself were crate digging and grabbing these things and putting them into music. You know, I know there's been countless Last Poets samples and Watts Prophet samples and that kind of thing. I think that will continue on for decades. In the same way that, you know, white singer-songwriters will discover Joni Mitchell and Dylan. Mm. Countless, you know, I think that this music is as timeless as the Beatles and the Stones and all that kind of stuff. And I often draw a parallel between classic rock, you know, which has sort of become the staple of the 21st century on FM radio, and this material, which I think is equally as valid. Hence, I made that sort of Woodstock mm-hmm. comparison. In terms of what people in general, the man off the street, regardless of their race or their age, it's been 40 years now. So this is history. I went through grade school in the 70s, and 40 years before that was World War II. So we would sit there and learn about D-Day and, various aspects of World War II. And in my mind, now it's time, it's 40 years later, let's revisit the mid to late 60s and the early 70s, you know. And in fact, you know, that period is changed and affected, you know, where we are in 2012. You know, we could sit here and debate, you know, what if Robert Kennedy had become president rather than Nixon, you know. So, you know, these are, in my mind, you know, it goes without saying, volatile and important decades. And I do a lot of lecturing to kids between the ages of 17 and 25. And they sort of look at me with this glazed over look. But, you know, over a period of an hour, they're like, holy cow, man, this is really cool. And it's a little more interesting than who, you know, General Eisenhower was, or, you know, who was Winston Churchill, you know.
Yeah. It's a part of history that still feels very vibrant and very real and very the way that history should feel. History should always feel kind of a part of where we are right now. And this very much captures that, I think, for a lot of different
people. And the cool thing is, you know, like Elaine Brown is still out there on college campuses lecturing.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these people are still around. Mary Brock is still out there doing poetry readings. So, you know, Los Angeles obviously is a great city to live in because these events happen if you go looking for them.
Yeah. You know? Very much so. I want to thank you so much for coming in, Pat.
And, well, thank you.
And talking about both this book and this collection. And, you know, I'm looking forward to much more.
Wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Why don't we close with the track that closes the collection and seems fitting, since you just mentioned Mary Baraka, and it seems like a nice sentiment, an interesting sentiment at least, coming from Mary Baraka closing out this collection and closing the interview out. Who Will Survive America? The name of this piece from Mary Baraka, originally on a record called It's Nation Time, African Visionary Music from 1972, on that Black Forum record label, which this would not have been put out if not for Motown, which boggles the mind in and of itself. So Mary Baraka, Who Will Survive America, from the collection Listen Whitey, The Sounds of Black Power, 1967 to 1974. Our guest has been Pat Thomas here at KPFK. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Who will survive America? Few Americans, very few Negroes, and no crackers at all. Who will survive America? Few Americans, very few Negroes, and no crackers at all.
Who will survive America? Very few Negroes, no crackers at all.
Will you survive America with your 20-cent habit, your throwback Jones? Will you survive in the heat and fire, actual change? I doubt it. Will you survive, woman, or will your nylon wig catch a fire at midnight and light up Sterling Street and your ass prints on the pavement? Grease was melting in this brother's eyes. His profile was shot up by a Simba. Thinking who was coming around the corner was really Tony Curtis, and not a misguided brother got his mind hanging out with Italian. Who will survive America? The black future will. You can't with the fat stomach between your ears, scraping nickels out the inside of nigger daydreams. Few Americans, very few Negroes. Maybe no red Negroes at all. Who will survive America? Who will survive America? The stiff-backed chalk lady Baptist in blue lace, if she shrinks from blackness in front of the church, following the wedding of the yellow robots, will not survive. She's old anyway, and they moving her church in the wind. Old people? No. Christians? No. First Negroes be invisible to truth. 1944 Minnesota? No, no. Nothing of that will be anywhere. It will be burned clean. It might sink and steam up the sea. America might, and no Americans, very few Negroes will get out, and no crackers at all. No crackers at all. No crackers at all. No crackers, no crackers at all. But the black man will survive America. His survival will mean the death of America. Survive, black man. 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 Black woman too. Survive, black man. Survive, black man. Survive, black man. Black woman too. Black woman too. Black woman too. Let us all survive. Who needs to? Let us all survive. Let us all survive. Let us all survive. Who needs to? Okay, okay. We wish each other good luck.